Welcome to the Student Press Law Center podcast for January 2010, a monthly rundown of news about legal developments affecting the student media. The Student Press Law Center is a nonprofit advocate for the student media, and we work to break down the barriers that prevent college and high school journalists from doing their best work. For more information about the center, go to www.splc.org. I'm Frank Lomonti, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. Thanks for joining us. Well, the cost of college is a significant issue for families across the country, and never more so than at this time of double-digit unemployment rates and still rising college tuition. But for a few hundred Illinois students every year, there's a free ride available for the asking if you know who to ask. For over 100 years, Illinois has allowed its state legislators to grant discretionary tuition waivers to the students of their choice. There's no income limit, and there are no minimum academic standards. In fact, each legislator is free to set his or her own standards. This discretionary scholarship program has been criticized by a few reformers in the Illinois legislature. They say that making colleges waive tuition for some 1,500 students each year just shifts the cost of their free education onto the backs of the paying customers. This scholarship program was kind of an open secret among the political community and the well-connected, but it wasn't widely known to the general public until recently when the Illinois media started asking tough questions about just who's getting these golden tickets, what are they doing to earn them, and how does it affect tuition for everybody else. Some of the very best and most detailed investigative work was done by a team of college student reporters in Professor Suzanne McBride's class at Columbia College, working in collaboration with a nonprofit news organization, Illinois Statehouse News. This team of journalists was able to get details of every scholarship given out in recent years, and they learned that some of these scholarships came with some questionable strings attached. The stories they gathered were compiled in a package of installments that can be found on the web at www.chicagotalks.org. We're joined on the SPLC podcast today by three people who were instrumental in bringing the details of this legislative scholarship program into the light of day. Professor Suzanne McBride of Columbia College is a veteran newspaper journalist who oversaw the students' work on this three-month-long project. Columbia student journalists Patrick Smith and Nicole Leonhardt were part of the investigative team that reported and wrote the series. Suzanne McBride, Patrick Smith, and Nicole Leonhardt, thank you for joining us. And first, let's start with you, Professor Suzanne McBride. Tell us a little bit about how a journalism class comes to take on an investigative project that is this ambitious and how the collaboration with Illinois Statehouse News came about.
Well, as in much in life, it was basically just luck. I had taken a group of graduate students down to Springfield, Illinois, as I do every spring, and in the midst of talking with a journalist down there who covers state government, he mentioned this story. And in fact, from time to time, people have kind of looked into the program, but no one had really done a systematic analysis and survey of what was going on. And so that kind of stuck with me, and he and I continued to talk through the spring. And I said, well, you know, I have this great group of students who take honor seminar every year. Perhaps this might be a project they would be interested in undertaking. So when I sent out the letters inviting people to join this class, you know, I shared this story idea with each of them, and all 12 of them were very excited about it and immediately had lots of good questions about, well, how does this work, and why does Illinois do this and virtually no other state do it? So I thought we probably had something good going on. And the reporter whose idea it was ended up leaving his Statehouse gig and joining the Franklin Center for Government and Public Integrity, which is a not-for-profit that is very interested in expanding state government coverage nationwide. So they're in the process of opening a number of Statehouse bureaus, including in Springfield, Illinois. And so they were very interested as they got started with their Illinois Statehouse News Service to, you know, do some high-end, you know, investigative work. So they were able to, they actually started the process in August before the students began their work. They, through a FOIA, were able to get the database of the last five and a half years worth of scholarship recipients, which numbered about 8,000. And they basically shared that database with us, and we kind of took it from there. And it was nice to actually have the database to begin just that first week, because we actually did this project in under 15 weeks, which I'm still kind of amazed that Nikki and Patrick and the rest of the students were able to do this that quickly, because I didn't have them for 40 hours a week every week for 13 weeks. You know, they were working jobs and going to class and doing other coursework than just this class. But I think because they were all very committed to it, and we kind of set up a system where, you know, we all did certain jobs, and we all posted our notes, and we had news meetings each week to figure out where we were and what we needed. I think that's how we were able to get it done.
Well, Patrick, the existence of the scholarship program itself wasn't a secret, but your reporting was able to find out details that weren't widely known to the public before. Can you go into a little more detail about exactly what some of the information in the background that your reporting was able to bring to light?
Well, I would say what we I think the most important thing that we found was just how there was such a lack of uniformity throughout this. And I'm not from Illinois originally, and so I was especially in the dark. I had never heard of this until Suzanne told me about the idea for the story. And it was this fact that there is just no consistency or uniformity about how it's advertised or how it's awarded or who gets it. And what that meant is that there's a lot of what seems to be a lot of inequity as to how it's awarded and who can find out about it. And what leads to is a lot of situations where no one's trying to do the wrong thing, but the only way you hear about this is if you're either very lucky or you are from the right sort of family that has political connections or is very involved in the community. And so I think it's not necessarily the most sort of sexy thing about the story, but I think that that's the really core issue that we found, was that there's no consistency to how this is awarded or who finds out about it at all.
Well, Nicole, your reporting specifically focused on not just who gets these scholarships, but what does this mean for the rest of the students who don't? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah. So it isn't so much a scholarship as it is a tuition waiver. So the students who get it have their tuition waived by the school that they go to, one of the, I believe it's 12 public universities. So they just have their tuition waived at this school. Well, since their tuition is waived, the school has to make up the money in other ways, since, you know, there's no appropriation. They're not getting it from the state government. So they have to make up that money in other ways. And some of the schools said they just have to, like, cut back on their budget. Other schools said, yeah, like, it is part of the reason we waive tuition, or we increase tuition for other students, is because we have to cover the costs. The University of Illinois schools alone, there's three of them, but they have to cover almost $10 million. It's 9 point something. And now I got the most recent figures for this year, and, of course, it did go up a little bit. So, yes, they're covering almost all that alone, and plus the funding that they're getting from the government has decreased anyways, on top of them still having to award these scholarships and lose that tuition money.
Another part of the series that you worked on, Patrick, maybe you can elaborate on this, talked a little bit about some of the unusual requirements or quid pro quos that some of the legislators imposed for students to qualify for those waivers.
Yeah, well, that was something where I think that it speaks to how bizarre this whole process is, that I feel like the some of the lawmakers who gave it out treated it as like their own little – their way to sort of gain support and gain helpers. And there, we found instances of people who were asked to, you know, even little things like march in a parade for the candidate, or big things like make calls for campaign donations or go door-to-door for a lawmaker. And you see the lawmakers sort of using this pool of scholarship winners almost as they see fit. I mean, not in, you know, in their offices. And I thought that was very odd.
Suzanne, you said something at the outset that I want to return to for a second, which was how the initial list was obtained. There's actually on that Chicago Talks website a link to a spreadsheet where you have several years worth of data that literally matches up with the individual legislator, which scholarships they granted. And that's quite a lot of detail that I suspect would have been very hard to get through the front door by making a Freedom of Information request to the individual schools. Do you know how that list was obtained and how Illinois State House News got their hands on it?
Well, actually, fortunately for advocates of good government and transparency in general, there is a state law specifically addressing this database, because I think normally this would be actually difficult information to get, specifically from universities. What the state scholarship law says, and this was a change that the legislature made several years ago, the last time that people were upset about the program and questions were being raised, they decided to make this database, make it very clear that it had to be made public. And so it's actually written into this particular scholarship law that you need, you know, these bits of information must be disclosed by the student and by these universities, and it needs to be disclosed to whomever asked for it. Actually, there was a reporter many, many years ago, 15, 20 years ago now, who undertook the task of actually going to several of these public universities and trying to get this information. And there was at least one university that did give it over, but then there were other universities that said, no, we don't have to, we're not going to give it to you. So I think his experience was another reason that they changed that law. So it made it actually much easier for us. It was quite easy to actually go to the state higher education agency. They're the ones who actually keep the data, and they very quickly, you know, provided it in electronic form, which was nice as well.
Well, that's a great reporting point that is worth emphasizing for people, even in other states. Even though that's a unique Illinois law, it's very often the case that when you can't get data directly from an institution, there's another entity, another organization, another agency that keeps that same information that's more forthcoming about it. In our experience, many student journalists run up against what's called FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, which is a student confidentiality law, but FERPA is binding only on educational institutions that are funded by the Department of Education. And so if you are lucky enough to find another entity, let's say a state auditor's office, a legislative committee, some other entity that's not a DOE-funded entity, they're not bound by FERPA confidentiality. And so they may be able to give you out the back window what you couldn't get through the front door. So that's a great little reporting tip for people in general to keep in mind. Nicole, let me ask you, I'm sure there were some uncomfortable interviews that you had to do in this process and some people who would probably rather not have talked about this. Can you talk a little bit about the having to confront some of the sponsors about the way they gave this money out and what sort of reactions you got?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, we split up the number of lawmakers, so everyone wound up taking about 15 to 16 and calling them, and some lawmakers would just talk to you and hand over the information. Other people, you would call and call, and, you know, whether they weren't answering the phone or having, like, one of their aides turn you down right away. I called one lawmaker at home, and she wasn't very nice to me, and we agreed that I would at least fax her the questions. I mean, we needed to get some information from her somehow, and she still didn't return my call. So, yeah, so we did. I think a few of us got yelled at a few different times. And then when we were talking to some of the students who received the scholarships, they, too, were kind of like, well, you know, why do you want to talk to me? It's like, well, I just need to ask. You know, we're just trying to – we're students, too, and we're just trying to do our job and find out more information about this. So it was, but it was a really great experience to get all the nervousness about interviewing people out of your system. You know, it's going to happen. People aren't always going to want to talk. So you just got to get used to it and find new ways to approach it to get people to open up to you.
Sure. That's great. Well, Patrick, can you talk a little bit about what kind of response you've gotten both from the reading community and then anything at all from the political community? Is there any sense that that your reporting may lead to a reexamination of the standards for this program?
Well, on the political side, that's actually what we're trying to follow up on and what I've been looking into, although at a very preliminary stage right now, is that while we were reporting it, I believe it was my classmate, was that, I think it was Emily, who had a few lawmakers who had previously not had a position who said that they were going to try and get rid of this. And I think that it was a result of all of this sort of attention that we were paying to the program, and they said that they were going to work to either abolish it or change it in some way. And so what we're trying to do now is to follow up on that and see if they're going to follow through on those plans. And from the readers, I've gotten nothing, but I was kind of expecting some sort of negative reaction or a stronger defense from either some readers or from some of the people that I had to call who were very angry with me before the story ran. And so far, I've heard nothing but really good things, and really people have been very impressed with the work, which I think is great and is really a testament to all the students who were working on this. I wrote one of the overview stories, but that would never have been possible without all the work that my classmates did. It was mostly me just looking through all of their notes that we had electronically available and trying to sort of cherry pick the very best stuff. And I've heard nothing but pretty great response to it so far.
Well, and actually that raises a great point, and maybe both Nicole and Suzanne, let's start with Nicole on this, and Suzanne, please chime in. When you're managing a project like this, you've got many, many weeks of work in it, you've got a dozen different people working on it, maybe they're doing it part-time, they're doing it around other jobs, they're doing it around other class responsibilities. Any tips or tricks or advice about pursuing a project like this, maybe any lessons that you learned out of it?
It was very like complicated, but I think our class communicated really well with each other. I had I worked with really great people. The kids in my class were awesome. Suzanne was awesome. It was never any big deal to call someone up and say, hey, I know you looked into this. Could you help me out? Could you help me find this information? Or to shoot them an email. I mean, we definitely shared everything we found. And even if we didn't use it in our stories, we at least had it in our heads as this kind of like background knowledge. So it was just great. I mean, it was a team of people I thought that worked really well together. We communicated well, and everyone found what they needed to, and we all kind of went above and beyond and just found all this really great information and shared it with each other. So it really made it, it was nice working in a team and, you know, having those people to rely on a little bit.
Well, Suzanne McBride, any tips, tricks, lessons learned? If someone listening to this is on a school somewhere else in the country, and maybe it's not this story, but they get a tip about a story that they want to look into, that they know is going to take many months, going to take many people, going to take lots of public records. What's your advice?
Well, I think first of all, just to take it one step at a time. I now look back at what Nicole and Patrick and the other 10 did, and I'm really kind of amazed. And not that I didn't think they could do it, but the feedback I've received, especially from really veteran, experienced journalists, they can't believe that 12 people were able to do this in, you know, about 13 weeks not working full-time on it. And I think a lot of it comes down to collaboration. I think that's actually one of the key parts of our future in journalism. We have fewer people doing journalism in general and investigative work in particular. And I think the only way we're going to be able to do these stories is by being able to all work together and come together and truly be cooperative and collaborative. And these 12 are my models for it. I mean, I think some of them knew each other before the class. They came from different walks of life in terms of life experiences. Some are broadcast, some are print, some are magazine. I think they really are a model for what can happen. And I think, too, you really cannot underestimate what a group of students can do. This is the fourth project I've done with students, and the first two have won national awards. And I feel very good about the future of journalism if, anyone listening to this, whether they're at a news outlet or teaching in a college or university, if they could just, you know, commit to doing one project a year or, you know, just try one every couple years. I just think of the amazing work that could be done, and I really do think that when I look at Nicole and Patrick and everyone else, I just feel really good about where we're going to be in journalism.
Well, that is a wonderful, inspiring, and upbeat note on which to end. So let's just end right there and tell everybody again that these stories are available, and please watch for follow-ups on www.chicagotalk.org. And we thank you so much, Suzanne McBride, Patrick Smith, and Nicole Leonhardt of Columbia College in Illinois. And we thank you for doing such important work that's helping to hold Illinois government accountable for the way public money is spent. For college journalists who want to learn more about using open records laws, we encourage you to visit the Student Press Law Center's website, www.splc.org. Check out all the helpful guides in the SPLC Online Resource Center. Become a fan of the Student Press Law Center on Facebook and follow SPLC_org on Twitter. And if you're a student journalist or a journalism educator with any question about your legal rights, call our hotline at 703-807-1904 or email us at splc@splc.org. Thank you for listening.